Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And our deputy editor, Matt Maitham.
Hello.
The two Matthews. This week, we're talking Matrix Resurrections with Keanu Reeves and Carrie-Anne Moss. Plus, we're rating Spider-Man No Way Home, The Lost Daughter, 9 Days, The Tender Bar, Swan Song, and The Kingsman. It's a bumper load of films out this week. Now, we can't tell you if The Matrix Resurrections is any good thanks to an embargo, but we have seen it, and... and you can look out for our review on GamesRadar.com/Total Film after 4 p.m. on the 21st of December. Right, shall we get cracking then? We've got a lot to talk about. But I mean, before we do though, we should talk about the other momentous thing that happened this week. What did we get in the post, lads?
Oh my God, we got a very special cake delivery from a very special person. Tom Cruise sent his Christmas cake.
The annual Cruise cake. I mean, it's not Christmas till that thing turns up in its beautiful white box with its cream ribbon and its sparkly prancing deer thing that you put on the Christmas tree and the beautiful thick cardboard note from Tom Cruise. And how does it taste, gents? People always want to know.
Mine still hasn't come yet. This time of year is terrible for my pace. But going by previous cakes, if it's anything like those, then yes, it's delicious.
Yeah, just to say that Tom doesn't send a slice to each of us. He sends his cake to me, but due to COVID regulations, we're not in the office. Therefore, I have sent the slices to the whole team. But Matt,
it was very good. It was light. It was well frosted. It was generously coconutted. Like, I can't say enough good things about it.
It's just the box.
Like, genuinely, coconuts were like one of my favorite sort of flavors anyway, like of sweet things. So like, you can't really go wrong, but it's a blooming good one.
It is. I've put a couple of slices in the freezer so that when I'm really depressed in February, you know, I can just slip them into my mouth and just think of Christmas and joy.
Really, the only word for it is...
So on that note, from Tom Cruise to Keanu Reeves, shall we kick off with our special guests and their chat to our very own Jack Shepherd, who sat down with Keanu Reeves and Carrie-Anne Moss last week and tried to prize some info from them on The Matrix Resurrections. Here's how he got on.
Thomas? You seem particularly triggered right now. Can you tell me what happened?
I've had dreams that weren't just dreams.
Am I crazy? We don't use that word in here.
Matrix has been part of both of your DNA for so long now. I imagine you must have potentially imagined futures for your characters, even though, you know, I guess they were doomed back then. Did anything kind of like, anything that you had seen in your heads come true in this, or was it all new?
Yeah, it was surprising. And I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah, I never fantasized in my mind of what this could have been. Until I heard that we were doing it. And then I had a few ideas imagining before the read through, like, well, how is she going to do this? And then when we had the read through, there was absolutely nothing that I could not have imagined what she created on the page.
I mean, I know when I thought about what, you know, I think Neo Thomas Anderson just wanted to be with Trinity and have like a kind of happy ever after. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen. And I think that feeling is really the kind of propulsion of the character in Resurrections, is kind of trying to get back to that.
With this, I found that the love between your two characters, because I mean, I rewatched all the films very recently, I found in this one, it was really, really palpable through the screen, you know, even perhaps more so than we've ever seen before. What was that like? Did it feel that way to you? Because the love between them is the propulsion for this movie.
Yeah, I mean, we had a scene where, I don't want to give too much away, but where we're together in the same scene, and it was really emotional playing that scene, right? Just kind of the yearning connection, stated and unknown, and almost, I mean, I know there were a couple of times where it was kind of overwhelming.
Yeah. for all of us.
Yeah.
For you and me and Lana and these yeah. two characters coming together and not together mm-hmm. and you want them together and all the history. And then I think how she layered those scenes with some flashback of the older, you know, the older version. I found that very surprised me how emotional it made me feel to feel all that history, you mm. know, the way she edited it, you actually felt the history, the 20 years. Yeah, that was really well done. I was moved by that.
You know, the film has some meta commentary and there are scenes with
Reeves.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, you know. And there are scenes, I mean, we've seen it in the trailer where there's a scene where like Neo is watching clips from the first Matrix movie and it's, you know, kind of mind boggling. I mean, were you getting like a sense of deja vu on the set? Was it quite surreal kind of recreating those moments?
Yeah, I mean, the scene that you're speaking about takes place in a movie theater and there's two chairs and it was the chairs that Morpheus and Neo sat in the construct from the original film. And then to see the images on a screen, yeah, it was, again, emotional. It was something promise and grief and present. And what the heck is going on?
I love how little they've kind of given away with all this. I mean, something that we can talk about, because we obviously know that Neo and Trinity are back, but you're slightly different versions of where you were before. And so, you know, you've done three movies as these characters, and to come back and do, you know, a very different take on them. Was it a whole new experience then?
Yes. Yeah, it was fun, thrilling, challenging. Yeah, because you have this kind of history and you have these connections, and the premise of the film, you know, you almost don't know it, but you feel it. And was that your past, right? You're like kind of going through a photo album and you're like, was that me? Is that me?
But I think also that anyone looking back at their life 20 years ago, we are different. Obviously the movie is taking that to a whole nother layer, but I know I look back at 20 years ago and I'm like, really? Was that, I don't remember that. Or, right? Memory is interesting.
She speaks about that in the film.
Yes.
Reality, fiction, reality.
When you read the script for the first time, like what aspect of it did you really connect with the most? Was it the journey your characters go on, or was it kind of seeing Lana's take on machines and mankind's relationship? What really kind of drew you in?
Story.
Yeah, the love story for me, for sure.
But all of those other things as well. But I think, you know, for me, and it was the through line, the whole raison d'être of doing it comes through that yearning, that perspective, that love from the characters, from the filmmaker to the film, to its implications, through all of the layers and things that you're speaking about, all of the sentient aspects of the characters, I think are revolving and thinking about love and reflecting back, well, then what are we doing? How are we doing it? What does it mean? What are the constructs? What's control? What's rebellion? What's freedom? What's true? What's false?
It's just engaging on like on a different level. And I think that's something that the filmmakers, you can sense that they just wanted your gears working inside your brain.
And there's some great Matrix action.
And some great Matrix action as well, exactly.
And it's funny.
There definitely are moments of humor in that. And, you know, it feels the same but different, which is so interesting. And so looking back on your Matrix journey, both this film and the original trilogy, what memory do you think you'll take forward and treasure the most?
I think, you know, working with Keanu for me is just amazing and something I really treasure. So getting to do that again, I didn't think we would do that again. Those moments for me were very special. And of course, working with Lana again and all of her incredible team that she surrounds herself with. And then I also think there's another piece that I am very moved by is when I talk to people, especially people who saw the movie when they were, you know, 16, 17, who were really impacted by it and are having these kind of deep philosophical questions about what it means and what is the Matrix. I really feel honored to be a part of something that asked that question.
So that is Keanu Reeves and Carrie-Anne Moss talking about Matrix Resurrections. We have reviewed it, haven't we, Matthew? Can we say whether it's a good review?
It's an excellent review because it doesn't give anything away. It's not spoilery. It assesses the film, gives you an idea of whether you might like it or not, but doesn't spoil any plot details.
Okay.
Very impressively done.
So we will find out exactly what we think of it on the 21st of December at 4 p.m. And then the film is out on the 22nd. So come back to find out what we thought. But shall we talk about something that we can review? Should we crack on with the other spoiler fest that's in town? Let's go to this. Your spider senses should be tingling.
When you botched that spell where you wanted everyone to forget the Peter Parker Spider-Man, we started getting some visitors. From every universe. Hello, Peter.
So this is Spider-Man No Way Home. We've been waiting for this a long time. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of conjecture of where it might go, who might be in it. Matthew, tell us, without spoilers, what goes on here?
Am I allowed to say Spider-Man is in it?
Yeah.
tread carefully about that, though. Come on.
Yeah, so this is Spider-Man No Way Home. This is the third part of the John Watts directed trilogy following Spider-Man Homecoming and Spider-Man Far From Home, and hopefully to be followed by Spider-Man Home Bargains in a couple of years, but we'll see. And this follows directly on from Far From Home, which the big revelation, which you may have missed because you might have been getting your coat on because it was right at the end during the end credits, is that J. Jonah Jameson revealed to the world Spider-Man's true identity, Peter Parker, and this kind of, and it picks up from here. That's the catalyst for this film. So this causes all sorts of disruption to Peter's life and his family, including Aunt May and his friends, Ned and MJ's girlfriend. As you've seen in the trailer, he goes to his fellow Avenger, Doctor Strange, and asks him to create a spell to make the world forget that he's Peter Parker so that the status quo can be restored. However, as you would expect, the spell goes a bit awry and then cracks in the multiverse, which was teased in Far From Home, but it turned out to be just that, a tease, actually comes to fruition in this one. So we get lots of people from the past appearing in this new Spidey's life, principally villains such as Dr. Octopus and Green Goblin, played by Alfred Molina and Willem Dafoe. And there's a few others as well along the way. And basically Spidey's mission is to kind of put all this back in the box. And there is an actual box as well. It's a very MacGuffin throughout this movie. It's a very ornate box that has secret powers that may or may not undo what has happened. So the question is, can Spidey put everything back and make sure the world forgets who he is? And get home in time for tea and do his homework and all those kind of things.
Yeah, get into college. I mean, this is also, you know, we're also very much about Spidey's angst about where he is in life. He's got his girlfriend, he's got his best friend. They all want to go to MIT. This is their biggest thing in their life as teenagers. Where are you going to go to college? Will you get in? Will you be able to live together? You know, how drunk can you get on Freshers Week? I don't think they discussed that, but they probably did off screen. So it's very much the sort of domestic as well as this sort of intergalactic, interdimensional story. It's also 2.5 hours long. So it's, you know, you need to sort your wee breaks out for that.
Yeah,
is it worth it, Matthew? Does it tick the boxes for you?
Yeah, up front, I would say I didn't enjoy it as much as Homecoming or Far From Home, but I did think there was a lot to enjoy, especially as it went on. It's the most meta. It's even more meta than Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I mean, it's a true fans movie, really, and it kind of harks back to the last 20-odd years of Spider-Man movies. I mean, there's so many Easter eggs and callbacks and payoffs going on. But at the same time, I mean, it's quite slow going to start with. It doesn't seem to quite know what to do with these characters once it gets them all together. Tone of it is not quite as grounded, I felt, as Homecoming or Far From Home, because you've got all these kind of metaphysical things and magic going on, which I find jar a little bit. You know, in comparison to the previous entries, which are very much about kind of these low-level villains who get their hands on machines and have a personal grudge against Peter. So that there's a slight change in tone there. But there are some great crowd pleasing moments. I mean, we went to the big press screening last night, and there were constant whoops and cheers. At
people
things.
Were applauding in that.
Keep it down, everyone.
They were, yeah.
Trying to watch a film here.
Yeah. I know. I don't need an applause every 10 minutes just when somebody turns up on screen. But there we go. That's what's happening now. Matt, did you like it? Did it work for you?
I have to say, again, I'm disappointed to report that I had very, very mixed feelings towards it. So similar to what Matthew said, I wouldn't really disagree with anything Matthew said so far. And obviously, this is one we're going to go into like a spoiler chat next week, you know, because obviously there's, you know, you don't want it spoiled before you go and see it. And there's a lot to talk about once you have seen it. I obviously went in with very high expectations, and you can't kind of, you know, separate this from the hype that it's kind of entangled with in the run-up to it. And it's been kind of so hyped. Definitely, I would almost go as far as say perhaps the most hyped solo Marvel movie for a very long time, if not ever. But the thing I said after the screening, when we were sort of debriefing outside the cinema yesterday, is basically it made me feel like I was dead inside, because
oh my god,
the reason why wow, is because there were things that were happening that I was kept feeling like this should be exciting or this should be moving. But despite having some like enjoyable moments, I never really felt anything, if you know what I mean. It just felt like it was sort of, I don't know, there was something sort of going through the motions about it. There was something unbelievable about, I mean, I say unbelievable, of course, you know, any film like this, you have to hugely suspend disbelief, but to the point where it lost me a couple of times. It asked too much suspension of that disbelief. It kind of hinged on things I can say that are sort of clear from the trailers. Is it hinged on Peter's decision to ask Doctor Strange to do this spell in the first place? Just didn't feel believable to me. It just felt like we have to do something to set these events in motion. So we're going to get him to do this. And it just, even at the barest of scrutiny, it just doesn't hold up to it. Doesn't make any sense why these two highly intelligent people would take part in this with seemingly so little kind of care and thought about doing something so huge, which is to, you know, make the whole world forget that Peter Parker is Spider-Man. It felt a bit cynical. It felt like, right, we've got to do something so that he can get these, like, you know, past villains coming back, that we can get the multiverse cracking open. But just neither of that felt true to either of their characters from previous films to me, which is again a problem with some other aspects of the film that we can't discuss. Despite all this, there are elements I enjoyed, I'm not going to lie. There's, like you said, there's certain moments that will get you whooping. It is funny, very funny in places. It's, you know, very slick. There's, you know, there is a thrill to seeing certain people, like, you know, someone who we can mention being Alfred Molina back. He's obviously just a great actor. So it reminds you what great actors they actually had for the villains in these, you know, original films. Yeah, there was things I enjoyed about it, but I can't say I came away entirely sort of satisfied, if I'm honest.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things that in the moment you're like, yeah. You're sort of buoyed along by it, especially if you're in a full cinema with a load of people that are really enjoying it. You're like, this is awesome. But it also then falls apart as soon as you pick any of the seams of it. You're like, why would he do that? Why would they do that? Why wouldn't they plan that better? They're both scientific people and, you know, people who work in surgery and people who are planning to apply for MIT, why wouldn't they have a flipping plan? You wouldn't do a science experiment without really considering all of the elements that you need in it and how it might go wrong and what the, you know, the outcomes might be. It just doesn't make any sort of sense. And there's obviously loads of things that happen then further down the line with these special guest stars where you're like, what? Why? And how did they come? And what's the rule of this? That's one of the other things that always sort of gets my goat. It's like, what are the rules of this film? Because it seems
there was
like
there was no internal logic to the multiverse.
No. And it's like, so that rule seems to apply for those people, but not that person. So why is that person doing that if that's the basis of it? So from that point of view, if you want to pick it apart, you easily can, and it falls very easily apart. But from a point of view of, is this Tom Holland's last film? We don't know. He's sort of said he really doesn't know if he's coming back. If this is his swan song, it's a great one to go out on, because I think it's the most emotional range we've seen him do. I really felt for his Peter Parker. And I thought, you know, the dynamics of his relationships with MJ and Ned and his aunt were really, you know, well essayed by him. I will say that.
I agree with that. And I think that's another thing why I find these films very difficult to review, because you kind of go into it knowing that, like, Tom Holland is very good. He's very good as Peter Parker and Spider-Man. He's a very good actor. Zendaya is great as MJ as well, just exceptionally kind of likable on screen and funny, and they have, like, good chemistry. So you go into it knowing that, you know, you go into it with just these expectations, like, okay, right, I know he's going to deliver on that front, you know, because I know he's good and has been good as Spider-Man in several films. I've even lost count, really, of how many he's actually done. You kind of go in with huge expectations. And I suppose just one thing, again, one final thing I'll say in a spoiler-free way, is obviously the kind of big moment we see in the trailer where Doc Ock returns on the bridge.
Yeah,
that happened much earlier in the film than I expected. So there's kind of a lot going on in the film that you sort of haven't seen in trailers, really. That sort of surprised me just quite how early this all started happening. So yeah, there's lots going on. And so obviously, please come back for our spoiler chat next week. But one other thing which hasn't really been mentioned yet by us, which I just would mention as well, is I almost feel like, because Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the animated film from a couple of years ago, because that covered similar multiversal crossover ground, it was just so good, that film. Probably, I would say, the best Spider-Man film for me. And this film has kind of shot itself in the foot almost by going on sort of similar ground to that, where that one was so good and so inventive and so stylish. Then this feels like they're trying a sort of similar trick with, you know, the crossover universe and everything. But wasn't quite as good on all fronts as that film, I didn't think. So that's
It sort of doesn't feel fresh anymore, does it? That when Into the Spider-Verse happens, you're like, oh wow, this is amazing. And imagine if these people were in a room together and there was that version and there was this, and all of these different dimensions were at play. That's awesome. And also the comedy that comes with that, and the friction that comes with that, is so well done in Into the Spider-Verse, and so visually spectacular in that film as well. One of the problems I had with this, I don't know about you guys, but I just found some of the scenes that we were seeing, the big action scenes, were so closely filmed and so fast, I actually couldn't tell what was going on. And some of the sort of special effects were just a little bit kind of uncanny valley, weird, I can't really compute it or relate to it. And I felt that Into the Spider-Verse was more visceral and felt weirdly realer to me, even though that's an animation incredibly imaginative, than this did.
Yeah, it was so vibrant, the colors and everything in that. And I agree with you, Jane, that yeah, it definitely gets that sort of like slightly gray CGI sludgy feel at points in this. And I don't know, I just have a soft spot for like when you're seeing actual heroes in actual costumes and actual stunts and things, whereas when they're these kind of like stretchy digital doubles, it just takes something away from it, where you can just tell that, right, that's just a, you know, digital double swinging through the air, moving in a way that, you know, a human body just can't possibly do that. I don't know. Yeah. It just takes something away from it. And again, I hate to use this term, because it's what everyone always uses and stuff, but it just feels a bit video gamey at times when just none of the environments or people or physics feel at all kind of a world we know, just diminishes it a bit for me. But it's one of those weird things. I say this is almost, I kept thinking about West Side Story weirdly, having seen this, in the sense that, like,
so much not the film, same film.
No, not the same film at all. And another film that I would ultimately classify as 3 stars. But at the same time, it's one of those films that I'd say it's 3 stars, but you still should go and see it, because there's a lot that's good about it, and a lot that's sort of well done in it, and a lot that you'll sort of appreciate of a night out in the cinema. But at the same time, I would just say with both films, they just didn't quite live up to the expectations of what I'd hope with the sort of, you know, materials they had to play with, basically.
Okay, so Matthew, you recommend that people go and see it, even though we've been sort of tepid, I think, but really it is a fun night out at the cinema, right? You know, we're getting towards Christmas. This is a blast if you go with your mates.
If you like superhero cinema, certainly, yeah. And if you've seen the other two Tom Holland Spider-Man films, then yeah, absolutely, you should see it. If you've been following Marvel as well.
You've got all of these multi-dimensions going on. Are you going to get kick out of that? Of course you are.
Yeah, from that point of view, yeah. It's a must-see. And it's the biggest thing out there as well right now.
For me, it's like a 3-star, but still a must-see, if you know what I mean. It's both a 3-star and a must-see. Yeah.
Yes, you wouldn't want to be the only one in your friendship group who hadn't seen it, especially with all the spoilers that need to be discussed. And obviously, you know, we have had the reviews drop today, and some critics have decided to go all out and spill everything. You know, and this is the discussion, isn't there, that that critics who don't do spoilers are just basically kowtowing to the marketing of the studios. I disagree with that. I think everybody should have the chance to see a film fresh and know nothing about it, well, as little as possible, unless you've been reading loads of fan theories, which obviously there are hundreds. I think you should go and not know anything about this. So try to avoid those reviews if you can, and just go and go for the ride. So that is Spider-Man No Way Home, which is in cinemas now. Swing out and see it. And do come back next week, because we'll have a spoiler cast dropping if you want to talk about that and that and when that happened and when...
Oh, and the other thing.
And when they turned up.
Oh,
and
my God.
And that thing with the doo-woppy thingy, you know, that bit, all of those bits. Let's discuss them next week. Okay, let's move on. It is time to go on holiday with this.
Children are a crushing responsibility. Happy birthday.
Mama.
I'm working. I'm suffocating.
So this is The Lost Daughter, which is Maggie Gyllenhaal's adapted and directed version of Elena Ferrante's novel, The Lost Daughter, but obviously takes some creative license with it. What does she end up with, Matt? What is this about?
Okay, so I haven't read that book, I must say, but I have seen this film. And at the centre is this professor called Leda, played in the present day by Olivia Colman. She's holidaying on a Greek island, but it's not just a pure holiday. It's a bit of a sort of study retreat as well. But there's basically another family on the beach. And within that family is Dakota Johnson's Nina and her young daughter. And Leda sort of starts to become almost a bit obsessed in a way with this woman, Nina, while at the same time kind of having these flashbacks to her earlier days when her daughters were young. And in that era, she's played by Jessie Buckley from Wild Rose. I almost can't really say much more than that, because there's not like loads of plot in that sense, but it's all about kind of, you know, the interplay between the sort of present and past as she reflects on her own kind of, you know, parenting, while also, you know, kind of becoming somewhat sort of, you know, obsessed or fascinated by this young mother and daughter that she sort of sees on the beach every day, and things go from there, really.
Yeah, it's very much a film that is mining a certain element of the female experience that isn't often seen on screen, isn't it? This idea of unnatural motherhood. They discuss, I'm not a natural mother, and the fact that, you know, Leda says to Nina at one point, children are a crippling burden, and voices those truths that I think women know to be true, that motherhood isn't all bread and roses, and is difficult, is hard, is challenging, and sometimes you hate it, and all of those things. And so this is, for me, was quite eye-opening a film. I found it incredibly exciting because I really didn't know where it was going to go, and this tension running through it. I mean, it's filmed like a thriller, but it's actually a psychological study of a woman at two points in her life, and the woman that is the catalyst for her remembering that. And I thought it was just fantastic. Did you like it?
I would say I absolutely loved this film, and would probably put it in my top 10 of the year overall, to be honest. You say it's a weird thing that on paper, obviously, it doesn't sound like there's that much to it, and there's certain things happen in it, such as, for example, the daughter of Dakota Johnson's character, the young girl, she loses her doll at one point, and just how that all plays out is just surprisingly kind of sinister and unsettling, even though it's something as simple as a child kind of misplacing a toy on the beach. And the whole family that Dakota Johnson's character is sort of involved with have a sort of an underlying sort of sinister edge to them. Then Like, I thought Olivia Colman was amazing in this, and also Jesse Buckley as well, as the younger version of the character. And she's kind of like an aspiring sort of translator, really, and clearly is sort of very good at it. And she's really gets torn between this kind of academic world that she wants to pursue and the sort of slightly stifling home life she's sort of, you know, almost trapped in a sense. And the way you kind of learn more about, you know, that as the film goes on, I just love this film. Yeah,
I did too. I think it's probably, with Power of the Dog, my film of the year, those two. And I think we're going to see a lot more of Olivia Colman at award seasons based on this. Because obviously we all know she's excellent, but what she does so excellently here is she plays somebody who isn't asking you to like them or respect them or agree with them, and doing it in such a way that you feel you absolutely understand them. It doesn't matter which side of the line you come down on, whether you think Leda is right or wrong. You absolutely understand her. And I think that's a tribute to Colman's performance, but also Gyllenhaal's direction and her writing. I think the script for this is so finely tuned, such an impressive debut from Maggie Gyllenhaal. So I would expect this film to be on the awards circuit for pretty much everything, to be honest. And also, you know, having seen Dakota Johnson do, you know, those terrible Shades of Grey films, to see her do this.
Don't forget the high note as well.
And the high note. I just think she's a really interesting actress, actually. And you actually see her at her full potential here, playing this woman who is, she based the look on a sort of a young Megan Fox, this sort of so sexual and bored with it, this long dark hair, that she's just trapped in this prism of what her husband wants her to be, and that she's struggling to get out as well. And that these two women are very, very different from very different backgrounds and have very different parameters, and yet meet in the middle on some level. But the implosion that might be if they do, I love this. I thought it was fantastic. And also, like, the cinematography is beautiful. The soundtrack's wonderful. It really sweeps you away to this island. You feel like you're there. And it's absolutely faultless in my mind. I couldn't pick something wrong with it.
Yeah, one of those films as well where the three main women are sort of great in it, but even just all the supporting cast is just kind of stacked out with kind of great actors, like Ed Harris is in there, Paul Mescal from Normal People's got a small role in there, and Peter Sarsgaard, he's got a small but kind of pivotal role in it as well, and is very good. So yeah, it's just kind of class across the board, really. And yeah, I saw this once in a kind of cinema screening, but I'll definitely watch it again when it hits Netflix.
And you also get Olivia Colman dancing like a banshee to Bon Jovi, which is worth seeing the film for alone. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so old. Matthew, are you going to watch this one? This has been like 5-star total gold treatment from us two.
Yeah, no, I'm really looking forward to this. I'm definitely going to watch it. Can't wait.
So that is The Lost Daughter, which is out in cinemas tomorrow, and then we'll be heading to Netflix. Watch it on the big screen or the small screen. Either way, I think it's very well worth your time. Okay, it's time to consider your life now with this.
Oh, not again.
You are being considered for the amazing opportunity of life. Selected, you will have the chance to be born in a fruitful environment where you can grow, develop, and accomplish.
Am I dead?
I wouldn't say you're alive or dead.
Are you the boss?
I would say a cog in the wheel.
How long is this process?
If you make it until the end, 9 days.
So this is 9 days. Matthew, what's happening in 9 days?
This is 9 days, starring Benedict Wong, who we've already seen in Spider-Man No Way Home. And this is another kind of metaphysical comedy drama, supernatural thing, although he is not the main character. The main character is Winston Duke who's also from, everyone is in Marvel, aren't they? You can't see a film that doesn't have someone from Marvel in it, or like
you have two to people be a Marvel. Yeah.
So Winston Duke, we know from Black Panther. And it's kind of similar in a way to Pixar's Soul, which came out around this time last year, in that we have these unborn souls who, before they can enter existence, corporal existence, they have to pass some tests, and the person testing them is Winston Duke's will, which he does in a house in the middle of a desert. And there's people such as Zazie Beetz, Tony Hale, Bill Skarsgård, and Benedict Wong, I should say, is kind of like he's Winston Duke's colleague, and he sort of pops in and out of this movie. And there's a similarity to Blade Runner as well, which will also come up in Swan Song, in that he basically does these empathy tests for these candidates as he interviews them about existence. And so there's a lot of big existential questions asked about whether they're fit to join humanity, to go and live full lives on Earth. So it's very sort of navel-gazy. And it all kind of takes place in this one house, more or less. Slightly claustrophobic, I found, I have to say. One of the other kind of features of the movie is that Will has this great bank of TVs where he's monitoring souls that he has dispatched onto Earth and monitoring their progress. So we sort of see things from their point of view on Earth and how they progress. So yeah, it's a very, very existential, navel-gazy, metaphysical puzzle of a movie.
That sounds like you didn't like it.
No, I didn't really. I kind of admired the ambition of it and the originality of it, and the performances all good. It's a really strong cast, and they all give strong performances. Winston Duke is very intense. Benedict Wong's very funny. Zazie Beetz is very likable and sympathetic. But yeah, I felt like it didn't really kind of add up to too much. It kind of sort of noodles around, and it just doesn't do what Soul did so much better, really, you know, contemplating the worth of existence and the fragility of life and what it all means.
I totally disagree. I love this much more than Soul. Soul left me really cold. It's one of the few Pixar films that really didn't do it for me, and I don't really know why. I just didn't like Soul at all, actually. Yeah. This one, I was like, this gets me. This, I found myself moved a lot of the time. The music is beautiful. I loved the idea that you start to think about, you know, spirituality, what's out there, your own life, what is goodness, what's the right thing to do in any situation. I mean, the empathy test that he gives them, you are always questioning yourself, what would I do? What would I do if my child was stood on a chair and I had to hang them to save other people, which is one of the first one he gives them, which is horrific. And this idea as well that, are there guardian angels? Is he a guardian angel? It's all very, there's no specifics. Nobody says, I'm a guardian angel, or I'm God, or you are this, or it's all totally up to you to interpret. So it works, I think, for any audience member with any belief system. You can choose to place it in any structure you like.
Yeah, it's careful to avoid any sort of affiliation.
Yes, it's not tacked to any sort of particular belief system. But that I loved, because it's definitely one of those films where it's not just fed to you on a spoon. You watch it and you fill in the blanks that are left for you. And so then the experience is entirely unique to you. And so for me, I found it really moving and life affirming and sad and sort of weirdly wonderful. It really did it for me. I loved it. And I loved Benedict Wong doing his weird sort of John Lennon voice. He walks in, he's like, you've got a cup of tea. It's just like, I forgot that he's British, because I keep forgetting that, because I keep seeing him as with American accents. And yeah, he was a delight. I loved it. And Will, you know, Winston Duke, just so, I mean, to overuse a word, but so soulful in this, and carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders as a person, an entity, who has to make these huge decisions. And sometimes that doesn't work out. So yes, I found it to be very moving. Matt, do you fancy it? Is it up your street?
Yeah. I mean, this has been a bit of an emotional rollercoaster in a sense. When Matthew was describing it, I was like, oh, that sounds great. And then he sort of reviewed it and I was like, oh, it doesn't sound good. Then Jane, really good. So like, I've been sort of you know, been on a journey.
Who do you believe more?
I've been on a journey, yeah. But it does sound very much up my street. And the thing is, I actually did love Soul as well. That was one of my favourite films of last year. And probably one of the films from last year that sort of stayed with me the most, to be honest, that I've sort of thought about the most like throughout this year. So, yeah, definitely up my street. Definitely going to give that a spin.
Okay, so that is 9 days and it's out in cinemas tomorrow. Right, it's time for Plain Talking. Time to demystify some speak from film. We're talking about match cuts today. What is match cutting, guys?
I believe I know this from one of my favourite films, which is 2001 A Space Odyssey. If I'm correct, that's probably the most famous match cut ever, where the bone is thrown up into the air and as it's falling down, it kind of cuts and, you know, matches up in line with the spaceship that we next see. I know that was sometimes called a jump cut as well, but I believe that is more accurately known as a match cut. Yeah, am I right?
You are. And you've probably seen there's like little videos going around on social of people falling over and then them being match cut into fabulous dancers. I don't know if you've seen that, where they fall and do that. That's a match cut. It is where something is cut so that it absolutely matches it and it goes from one thing to another just like that. Well done.
Can I say my favourite one?
Yes, go on.
There's one in Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula where Sadie Frost's head flies across the screen and then it cuts to a joint being hacked into a dinner table. It's very subtle.
Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. There's so much to go out there, isn't there?
What a film.
What a film. I particularly love, you know, Dracula on wheels as he sort of wheels into hallways and everything with the... with that hair that looks like a baboon's bottom. And I love it. I haven't seen
it for so many years.
It's dreadfully good.
Stays with you. Yeah.
Okay, it's time to move on then. And time for some daddy issues. It's this.
Okay, two rules. Queen of Corona. I'm never going to let you win. And I'm going to always tell you the truth. Your father is deadbeat. I'll take care of you. Teach you the male sciences. I saw you in the yard playing sports. You're not very good. Now find some other activities.
I like to read.
You read enough of those? Maybe. You could become a writer. One more thing, very important. Never hit a woman. Even if she stabs you with scissors.
Got it.
So this is The Tender Bar, which is directed by George Clooney, and it's based on the memoir of the same name by J.R. Moringer. And it's basically a story of a young boy growing up in Long Island whose father is a deadbeat DJ and is just never around and always letting him down. And his mother is struggling to survive. So they move back in with Grandpa, played by Christopher Lloyd. And living at the house is the lovely Uncle Charlie, who is played by Ben Affleck. And Uncle Charlie owns a bar and dispenses advice as well as pints. And this young man, JR, grows up with the advice of his uncle rather than his father in an exploration of how fathers don't have to be biological. They can just be people who help you and protect you through life. Neither of you have seen it because you are slackers. So here's a bit of fatherly advice for you. Do your homework, lads.
I was too busy getting drunk in a bar to watch this.
Were you? Was Ben Affleck serving you? Okay, so, I mean, it's a George Clooney film. And, you know, God love him. I don't think he's done a great directing job since Good Night and Good Luck. The rest of them have been perfectly competent, but they're not absolute sort of winners for my money. And this one is sort of similar in that. It's perfectly competent. It's perfectly nice. There's a lot of over-reliance on voiceover, which is sort of like a bit of a first base stab at adapting a book. When you compare that to Maggie Gyllenhaal's Lost Daughter, it's not being as efficient as it could be. And it's a story we've seen before. I mean, it sort of reminded me of Hillbilly Elegy.
God.
And and that sort of, you know, a poor boy growing up wanting to go to law school, and the sort of how does he get through that and how does his family help or hinder him? And Ben Affleck is just this absolute saint in this, you know, with the sideburns. He's just this gregarious, lovely bloke. He's good at sports. He's great at bartending. He's great at, you know, putting $20 in your pocket when you need it or telling you, you know, how to get through a situation. And he really pushes this child to want more from his life. But that's really it. There's not a great deal more from it. And it's sort of quite a weird one as well, that you know, it's coming out now when Ben Affleck has just made all these comments about drinking that are a bit dodgy on Howard Stern, where he sort of blamed his alcoholism on his marriage. So that sort of is an unfortunate dovetail to this film, where he's dispensing advice from behind a bar and drinking beers and shots. Yeah, it doesn't feel essential. Mm-hmm. Are you guys going to try and watch it?
I had seen the trailer and like I literally felt like it was one of those trailers that just condensed the whole film down to like 2.5 minutes for me, basically. So that killed a lot of my drive to actually watch it. And I must admit, Jane, tell me how he is in this film, but I find it hard to be won over by Ty Sheridan. Will this film change my mind on that front or not?
No. And also, like, and this is just me being picky, but the little child looks a certain way. Ty Sheridan looks a certain way. The two people don't look the same. So there's that weird disconnect that when you skip forwards and backwards between his childhood and then him as a sort of young adult trying to navigate college, you're like, I can't see that these two people are the same people. And I know I'm saying that having watched The Lost Daughter, which again, Jesse Buckley and Olivia Colman look nothing alike and are playing the same person. But there's a real emotional thread and various other things about it that really make you feel that they are one and the same person. And this felt like just two different people. And I don't know that Ty Sheridan brings a lot of depth to his characters, so I wasn't really feeling the nuance. Affleck, he's a really good actor when he does this sort of thing. You know, I loved him in Argo. He's great in Good Will Hunting. He's great here. He's doing this to the absolute nth degree. If you want to see a really lovely uncle that dispenses advice and is just the neighborhood good guy, then Affleck's nailing it. But that's really all that is. I've sort of seen that before as well with Paul Bettany in Uncle Frank, the nice uncle helping a young boy out. So it just doesn't feel particularly fresh.
Sounds like I made the right decision by slacking then.
However, the good thing about this, it is available on cinemas for a limited release from Friday, but then it's going to be on Amazon. And it feels like that's the best place for this. This is a film you definitely watch without expecting too much, and you wouldn't really want to spend a great deal of money or effort going to see it. And, you know, maybe it will touch souls of other people. It didn't touch mine.
If it's free, I'll watch it.
If it's free, I'll watch it. That's the criteria going with. Yeah. So the Tender Bar, it will be free, or you could watch it on the big screen and enjoy the cinematography, but it is out in cinemas tomorrow. Right, shall we move on then from the past, from Long Island, to the future now?
The second you tell your wife that you are dying, your opportunity to do this is gone. You want to go say hi?
Okay, so this is Swan Song. Matthew, what's it about?
The spooky thing about Swan Song is that it's the second film called Swan Song in 2021. So it has its own twin, which
is apt. It's very apt for this.
Yeah, very incredibly apt, because this is a film about a terminally ill man played by Mahershala Ali, who invests in a radical cloning program to create another Mahershala Ali, who's going to be called Jack, and who will replace him alongside his wife and child. And he will take on board all his memories, all his experience, so that his family can go on living with their husband and father without knowing that the original has passed away. So it kind of raises all these kind of ethical questions about what would you do if you had the chance to do this? Would you do it? Would you tell your wife and child that you were planning to do this? And then there's the whole kind of existential weirdness of being confronted with an exact copy of yourself, and how you would relate to them, how you would speak to them, how would you get used to them just being there in front of you. I should say it's all set in the future, obviously, as well. So it's got kind of Blade Runner overtones, where we had in 9 days where we had the empathy test. In this one, we have a bit of origami, which pops up now and again. So little Blade Runner nods. And it's got a terrific cast. There's Naomi Harris plays Mahershala's wife. And then there's Glenn Close and Adam Beach as the scientists overseeing the cloning program. And Awkwafina is in it as well, as another example of someone who's dying while her clone carries on in the real world. So yeah, it's kind of quite a lot to chew over in this one.
Did you like it? Did it touch you? I mean, this is dealing with death and, you know, what would you do in a situation? Did it get to you?
No, it didn't kind of check me up or, you know, really kind of get under my skin. But I did like it. I mean, I thought it's very well done. Lots of things I did like about it. I mean, the performances, for one thing. I think there's sort of a similarity with the Will Smith star of Gemini Man, but this is, handles it much better. You know, there's no kind of random motorcycle fights or gun battles or anything like that, or silly twists. So it kind of handles that idea much better of being confronted with an exact copy of yourself. And the other thing I liked is it doesn't have kind of like a dark science undertone. I mean, you often get in these kind of films that there's ulterior motives going on or there's something sinister. It really does just focus on the characters. It's not too sort of plot or twist driven. It does zero in on these characters and emotions. Paints a very kind of credible world of the future as well. The technology is very subtly handled. I mean, everything.
Self-driving cars. I'll have one of them.
Yeah, self-driving cars, the automated buffet trolleys on the on trains, even like watches and video games. It feels like one of those much more kind of credible visions of the future done very subtly. So I enjoy that about it. But yeah, ultimately, I can see why it would be moving and that it will really touch some people. But in the end, I just sort of felt, well, that was kind of pleasant. I enjoyed that, but not a great deal more, really.
But it has a pretty good meet cute, doesn't it, Matt? I mean, the relationship between Mahershala and Naomi as husband and wife, who we see first meeting on a train.
I'm sorry, but I would not be happy if someone was eating my chocolate bar on the train.
Right, exactly. I was just going to say that. I was livid.
Bloody kicked off big time.
Nearly lost me. Yes.
Can I just say somebody took my popcorn in the cinema at Spider-Man last night.
No.
So
are you now married to them?
I'm not now married to them. I wanted to kill them, but yeah. I think that was nice. It's beautifully handled, isn't it?
I really like those two moonlight stars reuniting there. I agree with what Matthew said in the sense that I really liked this world they created and this kind of subtle sci-fi future. And I thought, like, I don't know what the budget was like on it, but I thought it just looked really slick. Like you know, as you said, the cars are great. This kind of, they've got this technology where they've got these sort of special contact lenses in and these sort of earbuds in all the time. Things just materialize in front of them, like screens and stuff like that, and documents and things. But I thought that was just really well done. And I say this a lot, so forgive me, but it sort of reminded me in a way of like a sort of a high quality Black Mirror episode, almost, just as in like really high production values, sort of, you know, that intriguing concept that you'll be sort of talking about afterwards. And just classily done. It was another one that was, felt very sort of slick and classy like that. Just like an amazing cast, really.
The kid in it is adorable as well. He's so cute. He's so lovable.
Yeah. I think this is probably the strongest I've seen Naomi Harris since Moonlight. And so to have that sort of recall in your head when you're watching her and Mahershala, it does give it that extra sort of connection. And I also enjoyed seeing, you know, Glenn Close playing, you know, she's playing a scientist who's a bit haughty and we're used to her doing that. But just like there's a lot of empathy in her that I haven't seen for a while. And she's playing someone who's just really striving to do something that she feels is the best for the world and best for this person. And so I found that quite refreshing to see that. And also Awkwafina, seeing her play dramatic again. Like, yeah, we've seen her do this before, but she's really sort of low-key here. And it's quite refreshing there as well.
That was another little treat for me. Again, that, like, I mean, obviously I get the impression that Apple has a lot of money to spend on its content.
Do you? Where have they got this money from?
I mean, I can only guess. But they seem to do like fewer things, but they're all kind of ridiculously high production values, insane casts and everything like that. And so that was, I knew that Mahershala and Naomi Harris and Glenn Close were in it. So I was like, well, that's a pretty great cast. And then just Awkwafina just pops up in a sort of supporting role. And I'm like, blooming heck, like, this is a stacked cast.
All Marvel actors as well.
It's a Marvel world, Matthew. We just
one of them.
Also, I love the fact that you know, we were talking about the technology, but the technology does all look like Apple products. I mean, I'm sure
it
that,
does, yeah,
that
it really
car,
totally does, yeah.
I could totally yeah. believe that that was an Apple car. A lot of white products and things. But yeah, I thought, yeah, I'd like this. You know, it does deal with a lot of the similar themes as 9 Days, but I felt like 9 Days really got to me a lot more.
Interesting.
So it worked for me more. Which one did it work for you?
Yeah, I preferred this. I did prefer this. Apart from the chocolate bath, it did take me a while to get over that thing. But once my rage had settled, then I did start to invest in it a lot more. But yeah, it's so slickly done.
Production values, the locations, like, you know, the kind of facility where he goes to. I don't know, it sort of reminded me of Ex Machina in that way as well. Just it's just this amazing remote sort of, very modernist, isn't it? All those clean lines everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a thing of beauty. So that is Swan Song, which is out in cinemas tomorrow, and then we'll be hitting Apple TV Plus. And then probably the products will be hitting an Apple store near you in the future. I'm fully on board with that car, just saying. Apple, if you want to send me one to test drive, I'd be very happy to see how. Love that, wouldn't you? Like, if you need to get home from work,
so relaxed.
Your car just get, you just have a nap in the back. And it's like, you're here. You're listening to your music. Just, super nice.
The future of commuting.
Yeah, let's bring it on. Okay, finally, gentlemen. It's this.
We are the first independent intelligence agency. Refined but brutal. Civilized but merciless.
Welcome to the club.
Very clever.
It's time to pour fuel on the fire of revolution.
Yes, my shepherd. Welcome, Englishman.
Rasputin, your reputation precedes you.
So this is The Kingsman, which is from the Kingsman series, but this is a prequel, isn't it, Matt?
It is, yes. So The Kingsman basically jumps back in time 100 or so years to the sort of time of the First World War, basically, to look at how the Kingsman agency of sort of, you know, these people that are kind of protecting the world from the shadows, how that came to be, basically. So this film is all about that, really. So in that sense, it feels quite different to the other Kingsman films, like obviously where those were in the present day, and that was the kind of almost the whole point of them, was that they'd be doing this sort of modern take of Bond in a very modern day with a young kind of working class protagonist. Whereas this is very different. This goes back in time. I know Matthew Vaughan, I remember ages ago him talking about it and saying he kind of pitched it originally as like the man who would be Kingsman. So it has that kind of, he basically wanted to do like an old fashioned epic, and this was the way you could do it, basically, I suppose, by relying on that sort of IP that people know, but making a different kind of film out of it. I have to say, again, if I bring it back to Spider-Man, how I came into Spider-Man with such high expectations that sort of worked against it. And I would have to say for The Kingsman that it was beneficial to me that I went in with very low expectations, really not expecting a huge amount. And also, as well, I think it's one of those films that has been delayed so many times, as a lot of films have, but this feels like it's been buffeted around a lot on the release schedule. It's finally coming out, and I actually sort of quite liked it, went in with low expectations, and I found there was sort of a lot to enjoy about it, really.
Any fingering, though? You know, that's my question. Because fingering is a major part of 1 and 2, which I found wholly offensive in both.
I don't know if it's just Matthew Vaughan being a bit more sort of respectful because of the sort of World War One era. But I mean, no, there's none of that. There's none of that here. I mean, this time it's a sort of different class of character. So the main character is Ralph Fiennes, is Duke of Oxford, who's sort of, you know, a kind of a bit of a hero. And he's got a young son. They kind of face a family tragedy early on in the film and then jump to a few years later where his son's in his sort of late teens. His son is kind of wrestling with, you know, wanting to do the right thing in terms of volunteering, stepping up for war. But obviously his father's kind of against that and was trying to protect him. So there's that kind of tension. And they actually have quite a different dynamic to what Colin Firth and Taron Egerton had in the original films, whereas I was kind of expecting they would just basically rehash that, but they do take it down a slightly different route. Ostensibly, like, the maid of the house is Gemma Arterton's Polly, but she actually has a much more sort of, you know, important role, really, in kind of, you know, she's a key figure in this setting up of the sort of Kingsman agency, and she's like a key sort of ally to Oxford. Yeah, and Harris Dickinson is Conrad, who's Oxford's son, who's, you know, this kind of headstrong young boy who wants to kind of go out in the world and do his own thing. And it's strange because it's sort of a strange clash where it's definitely not as tasteless and as crass as the other Kingsman films, as you mentioned, Jane, no fingering. But at the same time, it is still wildly over the top in places in terms of the action, in terms of sort of Rhys Ifans plays Rasputin, who's one of the villains, and he goes like insanely over the top in a kind of enjoyable way. And then there's another mystery baddie. There's Tom Hollander's playing like the three cousins who are like King George, Kaiser Wilhelm, and Tsar Nicholas. And so he's a lot of fun. So it's a sort of a weird mixture of some quite serious war stuff and some quite silly business. But I must say I was entertained. I can't deny that I was entertained through this. And there are some enjoyable action scenes. It's fun to see Ralph Fiennes, you know, getting in on the action. There were actually like a couple of surprises as well for me in it. Like it didn't, like I said, I was expecting just a bit of a Kingsman rehash, but it had a couple of surprising elements. So I actually quite enjoyed it.
And how was Gemma Arterton's Yorkshire accent?
I don't know. I'll let you be the judge.
And that was a wig.
I thought it was
wigs and accents.
I thought I actually thought her accent was fine, to be honest, but you might feel different as a Yorkshire native.
And it's sort of from the trailer. We haven't seen it, have we, Matthew? Because we couldn't go to the screening that Matt did. But we probably will go and see it when it comes out, the completists that we are. It sort of feels a bit like it's a little bit of the Wonder Woman sort of fighting Nazis, Red Barony type of scenario, crossed with a bit of Bondian stuff, crossed with Biggles-esque. Is that a true representation? Is it sort of those sort of things mashed together?
Kind of, yeah, that's kind of fair, I'd say. Yeah, it's definitely a bit of a mix-up. And like I say, the war stuff is surprisingly serious, and there's some stuff of Conrad on the front line, you know, in the trenches, that's actually sort of on the kind of grimmer side for this kind of film, you know. It doesn't really sort of shy away from it in that sense. I mean, obviously, of course, don't go and see this as a serious sort of war film, you know, but you know, it's more respectful than you might expect. But then, yeah, then there's just some ludicrous, like, over the top elements as well, and some sort of, you know, there's a really great set piece involving like an old fashioned plane and a kind of dangling off a cliff and things like that. So then it's like, then even the baddies kind of gather at this ridiculous kind of cliff top base, which is, it's just so kind of, you know, over the top. But I was never bored throughout, and but I would call it a pleasant surprise.
Okay, if you would like a pleasant surprise, The Kingsman is in cinemas on Boxing Day. So take yourself out if you're sick of the family and enjoy Ralph Fiennes in a really great leather jacket. Okay, so that is this week's films. There's a lot to talk about and a lot to think about. But what was your film of the week? 2 weeks, because we're going up to Boxing Day. Matthew?
I'm going to go Spidey, even though a little bit underwhelming. It's still a Spider-Man movie.
As I said earlier, Spider-Man's a must-see, but The Lost Daughter is the film of the week for me, the film that I'll be kind of thinking about and revisiting much more over the years, I think.
Yeah, same. Lost Daughter for me, and also 9 Days. They both really got me, and I want to see them both again to see if I get a different experience from them and different nuances from them a second viewing. Okay, so before we go, we do have time for a reader's question. And the question is, what artwork from a film would you like on your wall? Matt?
I need to get the parameters here of the question. Are we talking real artworks that feature within films, or artworks that are created by people that within films, if you know what I mean?
I think it could be either. There isn't a specific thing on this. You can have it as either. It can be something in a painting that's on someone's wall, or something that somebody creates.
I would go for I can't remember what it's called, but the Francis Bacon painting in Batman 1989. Just because it's always stuck with me, because I love that scene where the Joker's sort of, you know, like dancing around the gallery to Prince, destroying everything. It's about to be hacked up, this painting, and he sort of says no. And that always kind of made me think as a kid, like, oh, it must be a pretty good painting. And it's quite grim. I'm going to see if I can find a name for it, but it's something, you know, it's a Francis Bacon one, and it's got like, looks like a body cut in half or something. A figure with meat, head surrounded by sides of beef is what it's called by Francis Bacon. So I'll go for that. Thanks.
Lovely. I don't know how much that one's worth. Matthew.
Can I have a statue?
Sure.
Does it have to be a painting? Can I have
no.
A statue?
I think that's okay. It's an artwork, so it can be anything.
Yeah, the Rocky Balboa statue.
I knew you were going to say that.
Oh, of course.
Which actually exists and is at the Philadelphia Art Museum. You can actually go and see it and stand next to it and have your picture taken, as I have done. Yeah, I'd go for that. I don't know where I'd put it. I mean, I'd have to move a few things out, you know.
Can you not just stand it in the garden? He runs up those stairs in any weather, so I think he'd be all right in your garden.
Yeah. Birds have been pooping on it though, wouldn't they?
Yes.
Have to be shining and buffing
you just,
it every
you just
day.
you have to take care of it just as you should.
But yeah, that's the one I want.
Okay. I would go, and it's probably very predictable as well from my point of view, but I would want the painting at the stairs in Mandalay that the narrator chooses, well, is manipulated by Mrs. Danvers into creating a costume like for the ball that incenses Mr. De Winter and sets all sorts of awful things in motion on the night of their party. I think that would be great.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Which version? Hitchcock or Weekly?
Hitchcock, the white dress and the hat. Yes, not the red dress. Okay, so those are our works of art. We've had some works of art to discuss this year, haven't we? We will be doing a Spider-Man spoiler cast next week. And then after that, we'll be doing our review of the year, where we'll be talking about all of the goodness and all of the works of art we have been watching and some of the not so works of art this year. So do join us for that. But for now, it's time to say goodbye. Say goodbye, boys.
Bye.
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 Gentlemen, let's broaden our minds. Lawrence.